Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, room full of people like you, and a little bit of effort on my own. I haven't had to take a drink of alcohol or do any kind of narcotics since May 11, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. Glad to be here. Glad to be sober. I want to thank Jeff for inviting me this weekend. It's good. And Jeff and I kind of go back to Bakersfield and Oildale, the good old days. And probably a lot of you don't realize that Jeff was once a police officer, and they found out he was dyslexic because he kept giving IUDs instead of DUIs. Man, I love it. I love it. There's nothing worse than getting it on than it is to wait to get it on. Man, I've been waiting and waiting and waiting. But I'm glad we waited because four people came. Yeah, yeah. Oh, man, Pikey. Pikey set my soul on fire today. I don't know if you guys heard Pikey, but, man, he lit it up. I could have gone home, man. I loved it. AA, best AA talk I've heard in years, man. He said he hadn't talked in 6 years, but he stored it up, man. Imagine what he'd be like if he didn't talk again for 12 years. Pikey used to be the pool lizard at down at Palm Springs, man. He was the idol. He was the girl's dream, man. Down at the old Palm Springs Roundup. When I was brand new, I've seen Pikey down there, always around. I've seen him around. I'm grateful for people like that throughout my entire sobriety. And there's people here tonight that have seen me all throughout my sobriety. I'm grateful for that. My home group, guys from my home group are here, gals from our home group. I'm really grateful that they came to support this meeting tonight and be a part of this weekend. And you know, I'm grateful that I've got people in my life that, they saw me come in, saw me come back, and they saw me come in, they saw me come back, and have seen me throughout my sobriety. There's guys that I are here this weekend that I've seen almost daily for 18, 19, 20 years, and accountability and consistency, and been through a lot of things, and that's the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. My wife's here. Really grateful. There you are. I can't see. It's the glare off my head. I had to shave my head because I woke up one morning and my head looked like a toilet seat. Had this thing that went around it, you know. I told my wife, why don't you tell me my head looks like a toilet seat? Mm-hmm. So, anyway, Sue's here with me this weekend. Sue and I have been together 45 years. Well, it may not be exactly 45 years, but I'm going to keep saying that until it gets to be 45 years. We're close. We're close. We've been intimately involved for 45 years, right up including last night. Yeah. I do my best work in a free room. Yeah. Yeah, she's my wife, my lover, my very best friend, my buddy, but she's not my sponsor, and I'm grateful for that. Oh, man. Man, that's great. And anyway, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today in a general way, I don't know anything else. I really don't know anything other than my story, and I'm sticking to it. I'm grateful. I've got people that saw me come in and saw me, 12-step me and have been in my life so that I can't change my story. They call me up and let me know, and I'm grateful for that and keep me honest. I got a sponsor. My sponsor's sober. My sponsor's Chino John from Pomona. He's been sober 47 years, and my sponsor tells me, get in the lifeboat. We don't need a captain. You know, so when you're going through hell, don't stop. You know, he gives me all kinds of, you know, good information like that. And I'm grateful for people like that in my life. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but when I had my first drink, an alcoholic was born. And I was born in the Texas-Oklahoma panhandle, kind of no man's land out there. And I was born into a family of alcoholics. My dad was an alcoholic. His dad was an alcoholic. His dad was an alcoholic. And his dad was an alcoholic. And so on and so forth. About five generations as far as I could check. And, you know, that isn't a big, that isn't, you know, if you're a budding alcoholic, it's a good place to grow up in a, in an alcoholic home. There's alcohol there. You know, it's readily available. The thing of it is that more importantly in my case is each generation got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse until it got to me. And I'm the worst, best, worst example of my family there is. And, I give it my best shot. And, by the big book and the definition of alcoholic, I'm a type 4 alcoholic. And by the time it got to me, I was doing my best to cover all the bases. I can assure you that. And, I grew up in a farming community, and when I was 12 years old, I could get a farm permit and I could drive. It was dry counties. They had bootleggers, homebrew, white lightning, moonshine. Didn't have no things with umbrellas floating in it or nothing like that. You know, I mean, drank that stuff strictly for effect, and that's the way I grew up in that part of the country. And a farming community. I had a driver's license when I was 12. When I was 12 and a half years old, I was arrested for leaving the scene of an accident, an alcohol-related situation. And as a result of that, I was incarcerated from the time I was 12 and a half years old, 13 years old. I was incarcerated in a correctional facility until I was equivalent to a senior in high school. And the amazing thing about it was during that period of my life, I did pretty well because it was very strict control and very strict punishment for anything you did wrong. And there wasn't alcohol or any kind of narcotics or anything like that. About the best we was able to do is sniff the gas out of the nurse's car once a week when she came, you know, go huff a little gas. But I never got addicted to that, you know. I don't know why. This wasn't my bag, and I did it a couple of times. And they had them old inhalers that had the cotton in them that, you know, Benzedrine, Dexedrine in it, and you'd cut the cotton and swallow it, and then you'd have to throw it up within a few hours or else it'd swell up and constipate you for a month, you know. I mean, it had side effects. Side effects. Didn't have that on the thing, but it had side effects. But I was locked up in a room, about like a 4x8 or 8x10 room sometimes, and I would swallow that cotton and get that Dexedrine or Benzedrine in me, and it was like I would stay up for 3 days. I don't know why, but I, you know, I did it. I mean, that's a little bit of step two, you know. I'm locked up in a room with three other guys, and I'm going to do something that's going to keep me awake for 3 days. I didn't want to miss anything, you know. And I got out of there, and during that period of time while I was incarcerated, there was no women there. There was a lady, young girl, came to the fence and with a man in a suit and told me to sign these papers, and they would, and I would be married, and she'd come back later and give me favors, and she didn't, and he didn't, and they annulled me or something. I don't know what I had to do, some with her staying in the country or something, but I thought about her a lot. I needed something to think about, and I thought about her a lot, and when I got out of there, I guess that was probably the beginning of my abandonment issues, you know. I didn't know that then because they didn't have anger management, you know. But anyway, I started all those little things along there, but I did good during that period of time. I participated in sports and what have you. There was a good period of my life there, and but I would occasionally get an opportunity to drink. I got out of that place, and I went back to home, and I met a young lady who was sweet and innocent, and her father had a lot of money, and my grandmother told me it doesn't take any more effort to marry a rich woman than it does a poor woman. It just takes more effort to keep her. And so I married this young lady. Her dad was very wealthy, and I immediately got a, you know, that was gone in 9 months, and there was nothing conceived. It was over. And during that period of time, my father was a graduate from the University of Oklahoma Law School. He was an alcoholic lawyer, and I never resented that. Kept him on retainer for years. And he wanted me to go to school, and that period of time I went to the University of Oklahoma, and I actually played football under Bud Wilkerson. And that was a period of time whenever I was able to do something. I was fast. I was short and fast. I mean, you know, you're just fast. It helped back then if you had some speed, but I had an acquired taste for that. It's like going 190 mile an hour with your feet nailed to the floor, you know. I mean, it was just, I mean, these were days before all that stuff. My uncle was a doctor, and he gave me that kind of stuff, and I was an overachiever, and I was able to do those things there, and I went there for a couple of years, and like I say, went through this divorce with this young lady, and her father threw me away. People are always throwing me away. I like the way Pikey talked about the fact that this is a progressive disease, and I had plenty of opportunities. I came from a good family, and I went to school, and every time I was locked up, I went to school. And shortly after I left the University of Oklahoma there a couple of years, I was bootlegging, and I got busted. And, I was running whiskey from Wichita Falls, Texas to Oklahoma City, and I got popped. And, that was more important to me than any sports or anything that was going on in my life. And that divorce came down. I was in an automobile that had some, outside issues in the trunk. And they frowned on that down in Texas back then. If you had a joint in your car, man, you did 25 to life. You know, I thought that was funny. I'm not even planning on living that long, you know what I mean? But I had to go one more time incarcerated. And during that period of time, I went, they didn't have all these special interest courses or anything. They had correspondence courses. I took correspondence courses. As long as I was locked up in a cell and had nothing else to do, well, I read and I did things like that. And I got some education, and when I got out of Huntsville, I came back home one more time, and I went down, where the action was, because I liked them honky tonks. I grew up where the honky tonks and honky tonks, all them old guys, them old country and western stars were coming through town in cars. They didn't have them buses and stuff. Conway Twitty and Hank Williams, all them guys were running through there in them little honky-tonks, and they had all these little faraway places out in the middle of nowhere, Wolf Creek and places like that, and people drank that moonshine and white light and homebrew, and, every bottle you took a drink out of it had a broken seal on it, but everybody had a good time, and we had danced and had a good time, and I came into this place at midnight, and the band was taking an intermission, and I wanted some action. I started to fight, and the fight got out of hand, and I ducked into the woman's restroom. I may be sick. I'm not stupid, And I ducked into the woman's restroom, and there was a lady standing there, and I said, "Tell me when the fight's over." And she came in pretty soon and said, "The fight's over. You can come out now." And I came out, and the band was playing, and she was handy, and I'm a quick study. I said, "Where you been all my life?" And she said, "I don't know. Where you been?" I said, "I just got out of prison." She said, "Well, I just got an unwed mother's home." And I said, "We deserve each other, I mean, really." And, one quick dance, I found out she had a car, a job, money in the bank, a driver's license, all the things I didn't have. So I asked her to take me home with her. And it was so sick, it had to be love. I mean, the rocks in my head fit the holes in hers. It was just like, that's 45 years ago, baby, and we're still together. I don't know if you call that soulmates, but and that's not because I didn't believe in divorce. It's because she didn't believe in divorce. She believed in homicide. It was so sick. It was so painful. It was so. In 2 weeks, in the community where we lived, they nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. I mean, it was just it was so sick. It had to be love. I know if we work on this for the rest of our life, we can make it. You're just about ready. And it was just, it was absolutely insane. That's what it was. And we kept at it. And a couple of years went by. I don't know. I guess I was crossing over the invisible line, I don't remember. But I was drinking and getting a lot of trouble and doing all the things. And I was a worker. I'm a worker. I work. Not a bum, man. My family come up through alcoholism, and they worked. And they worked hard, and they drank hard, and they played hard, and I worked. She said she was pregnant. I worked, and she said she was pregnant. And I mean, I really did. I gave it my all, and that I was the father. Okay. And so we got married in Amarillo, Texas, in a preacher's house on Saturday afternoon. Preacher married us in Amarillo, Texas. He's drunk. I was drunk. My mother-in-law was drunk. The guy, she was drunk. the preacher's wife was peeling onions in the kitchen. We were all crying, and I was supposed to give him $50, and I stiffed him for 30, you know. And he just smiled as we left, you know. I mean, it was just, and we started out the rip-roaring life of an alcoholic, and I was doing things, and working and trying to put things. I had no clue. I had no clue what it's like to be a husband or a father or anything like that. I had examples of people ahead of me. There were some good examples. And my grandmother was a school teacher. She taught school for 54 years and never missed a day because of illness. And it was her program. It was her life, a school teacher. And my grandfather was a drunk, a devil-may-care chap, and he hardly ever worked. He was a gambler, and he was always playing. He was a prankster, and he was always a character is what he was. But there was good examples. My grandmother worked and went to school and taught school. And it was people that had some brain cells. We had a little, you know, retardation. You know, there was a couple of threads of nuts in there. I mean, you know, I wouldn't call it dysfunctional. It was just crazy. You know, I had one brother that drove a steering wheel around town, you know. And it's a small town. Nobody bothered him. But when he parked his steering wheel in a parking place and somebody parked on his steering wheel, I really got mad. I went crazy. I was crazier than him about them parking on his steering wheel. They locked me up because somebody parked on his steering wheel and I kicked the headlight out of the car. You know, I mean, it's just... he never said a word in 28 years. And, if he wanted to go to the bathroom, he'd unzip his pants and pee, you know. And nobody said anything. They cleaned it up, whatever, you know, the deal. But I'd be drunk standing somewhere and just pee my pants and just walk off, you know. And nobody, I'm crazy. They'd say, I'm crazy. He's crazy, you know. And I'm going to tell you, it was just kind of a reputation you had to deal with, you know. And you step in here, you got the whole deal. And Sue married me, and we started out a life of that crazy thing. And there was periods when I try to do that. I mean, I don't really like to work. I can watch you work all the time, but I work. And so sometimes there's options. And my folks were educated people, and they decided that I should go to school. And I let them think that it was a good idea because it beat working. One time somebody asked my dad, what's Junior majoring in now? And he said, I think he just changed his major to electrical. He's learning how to wire home for money. Yeah. But I went to school, and you know, I took as long as I could. I took as minimal amount of courses, and I always had a hustle going somewhere. And I ended up going to a university of Oklahoma State University, and I was able, after a period of time, I don't know how long it took me, but it took me longer than it should have, I was able to graduate there with a degree in metallurgy and engineering design. And I drank through that period of time, but I had a family, and she worked, and a kid. And I wasn't just a raging nut that couldn't do anything. I went to class and paid people to take my tests for me, you know. And I had people write my essays or whatever, you know. And I got through it, you know. What the heck? And I like the deal. I don't care if it's 50 cents or 50 million. Deal me in. All I want is that piece of paper. And I got that piece of paper. And I also got in a lot of trouble. Shortly after I graduated there, I was involved in another hit and run, leaving the scene in the accident with bodily injury, alcohol related, and it became necessary for me to leave town. And I loaded up my wife and daughter and a station wagon, put the stuff in the back, whatever we had, and headed for California because a friend of mine named Lion Shorty told me I could get a job on a ranch 40 miles west of Long Beach. A guy named Lion Shorty wouldn't lie to you, would he? Huh? Huh? Nah. Oh, ye of little faith. And I loaded up all that stuff. We headed for California. Actually, I had interviewed and I got a job with a major corporation on the West Coast, and I took a job as an intern or whatever, I mean, a new engineer or whatever they'd give me. What I was an expediter. Now, if you're a real alcoholic, you know what an expediter is. That means I can get anything, anytime, anywhere, any time of the day at a primo cost. And I started working and doing the deal. And I traveled all over the world and went places. I can't even tell you how long it takes to get there, but I can tell you how many bottles of whiskey it takes to get there. And I had a lot of money at my disposal, And I would come home and from being gone, I'd been in Alaska or Peru or some place, you know, wherever in the heck it is. And I would come home and I hadn't been around there in a while. And, you know, I bought a house for $20,000. The payment was like back then in the 60s or 70s, it was like, you know, $175 or $125 a month. And I couldn't make the payment. If Sue hadn't had a job and made the payment, so they'd have a place to live. She worked and took care of our daughter. And I just ran and did things, had fun. I went all over, had running buddies and worked offshore in New Orleans, offshore. And, you know, I went to Alaska one time and I was working up there on a rig and I hadn't had a drink in about 3 or 4 days, run out of whiskey, run out of chewing tobacco. I was working on a rig up there, and I come down off the rig and said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to get my coat." And he said, "Where's your coat?" And I said, "Amarillo, Texas." And I never went back to that place. You know, I just, it was just, I'd show up at the house, and it was like I'd open the door, and here I am. I have to introduce myself. I used to love old Norm. He'd say, "Yeah, baby, I'm home. You know, it's me, your labor-loving daddy, you know. I'm married to her. You know, I don't need to introduce myself to her." She, you know, but she, her, like her mouth was attached to the doorknob, and she'd just start yelling and screeching at me and embarrassing me in front of all my friends. You know, my friends, the guys I brought home with me, I always brought people home with me. My friends, my very best friend, come on in. And you know, I didn't take care of anything. That house, in a short period of time, that house was painted 4 different colors because I lost interest easy. You know? Yeah, I mean, it wasn't red and yellow or anything. I mean, it was a little bit brown and a little bit white and a little bit of cream and a little bit brown and yellow and cream, you know. And had some antiques in the front yard, you know, Corvair and an Etzel. Yeah. And things, you know, a lot of things. There was a lot of stuff. I was always coming or going, and the doors swung, you know, they'd lock, and we'd run right through the doors. The door jams were tore off, and it was just, you know, it was a mess, and I would leave. And, I had absolutely the progressiveness of my disease. I didn't come from that kind of. I came from upper middle-class people, and I'm living in a house. I got my wife and my kid living in a house that it tore all up, and there's nothing, you know, hooked up to anything, and there's nothing works, and the grass grows, and you're putting more boulders out in the front yard. That's all cactus. And I had no shame. I had no shame for where I took my family. And I was getting in a lot of trouble from, I left somewhere and I was going down the street, and you know, I had one of those drunk feelings like, ah. And I drove up a car, one of those car haulers. I drove up a car hauler, was unloading out there, and I drove up out over the top and landed in front of the car hauler in somebody's car that I don't know whose car I was driving. It was just like every time I would just reach that plateau, why just, something else would happen to me, and there I am again. And I ended up, you know, with a pending case in L.A. County, in San Bernardino County, in Riverside County, you know, in San Diego County, and you know, La Habra and Whittier, and I had lawyers going. I tell you what, I bought that house for $20,000, and when I lived in it about 10 years, and I owed $140 on it. From lawyers and bondsmen and patios that I never built. And it was just tore up, and we had an old Pinto station wagon, kind of a baby poop brown Pinto station wagon with no reverse. And the whole neighborhood was going down. Hippies lived next door to me. They moved in, and some guy owned a chrome shop, so he moved in next door, and really he was the president of some motorcycle deal or something, you know. And I don't care. You know, I mean, just more neighborhood to hood, you know, and I just doing the best I could, and I'd come home, and there she'd be, wanted me to do something else, you know, work on this, fix that, you know, go there, you know. Had a 120-pound German Shepherd dog, and I put him in a dog run, and I never cleaned the dog run. I'd come home, and she'd lock me out of the house, and I had to go through the dog run, and that's bad. Whatever you've been through when you get home, and you go through the dog run, that's bad. That's bad. You know, and the dog's trying to attack me, and I'm saying, "It's Daddy, I'm home," you know. And it was just a constant rage, And you know, the neighbors, she didn't drink. She just kept getting worse and worse. They get crazier. The neighbors would yell, "Shut that woman up over there," you know. She just, the cops would come to the house. We'd be having a fight, and the cops would come to the house, and she just, you know, non-drinkers just go crazy because we sober up quick when the cops come. Bing. You know, it's her. And they put the cuffs on her, and then the cop says something. "Now you got it right," you know. Cops say something bad about her, and then I'd hit the cop because you can't talk bad about her. I'm the only one that can talk bad about her. And then they put the cuffs on me and take me down, lock me up, and then she can come down, write a hot check, and get me out. Because that's the way it is, day in and day out. And I finally, you know, got tired of that, and I ended up in court. I'd been in a fight, and I had somebody put a big boulder out in the middle of my. I think I won in a crap game, tell you the truth. But I brought this huge big boulder home some way in a big truck and dumped it right there. And then the hippies were having a party, and they got in a fight with the people next door, and they rolled a boulder in the middle of my driveway. And that ain't right. No, that ain't right. I went out there and tried to get them to help me move it out, and it was the biggest fight. It's like in one of them Western things. You know, them are beating the hell out of them, and they're beating the hell out, and everybody, and I'm just standing there saying, "That's the boulder, move the boulder, move the rock." You know, this is for a real rock. You know what I'm talking about? A big rock. And cops came and arrested me and took me down there. Some guy hit me upside the head with a crescent wrench and almost tore my ear off, and I was on a gurney in a jail hospital ward. And laying there all night and all blood-soaked. And I had this big bandage on my head and a, you know, blood-soaked ear muff. And I'm tore up. I got, you know, no identification on me, no underwear on me, no socks on me. I'm traveling pretty light from being somebody that's from the local area, you know. And, yeah, I didn't want to be an embarrassment to anybody that knew me, so I never carried identification. Rational alcoholic thinking, isn't it? And anyhow, I ended up in front of a judge, and the judge's talking about me, and he's got the right guy, and so he's going to put me away, and I, you know, some kind of a deal with some kind of a court card thing, whatever it was, you know. Yeah. I don't know what AA is. I've been doing B&B, but I'll take A&A rather than go to, you know, jail for an indefinite period of time. I'm going to lose everything if I go to jail. You know, and I owed people in jail money. That's why I didn't want to go to jail. That's the real truth. And so I got this thing, and they brought there's a few people here. You know, Pikey was talking about some of the old guys. Well, Ivan Miller from over in Fullerton was an old machinist, and Ivan's eyes drooped in his hands, and he had them machinist hands, and he drove an old beat-up truck. And he'd go up to the court and get the court guy. And they brought Ivan up there to get me. This was in the early 1970s, and you know, Ivan was like from AA. Ivan looked like he was drunk that morning. You know, and Ivan didn't say much. You know, come on, we go out and get an old El Camino beat-up pickup, you know, and he drove me around and showed me a couple of AA places, you know. Ivan knew I wasn't going to be through drinking. He knew that. I mean, he'd been around AA for over 20 years at that time. And he finally took me home, dropped me off, and said, "Yeah, okay." And he never gave me his phone number, told me where he went to meetings or nothing, because he knew, okay, Slick, well, you got out, now we'll see. And I laid down on the couch. We had an old vinyl couch, and I stuck to the couch, and she came home. She'd been to see a lawyer, and he told her I should go to AA, and I let her think it was her idea. And so we got loaded up in the old Pinto and headed for the AA meeting. And, you know, she had the hairdo with a can and a half of spray net in it, you know, Leaning Tower of Pisa. And the kid looked like a wounded animal. My dog had chewed all the hair off his body everywhere his mouth had reached. He looked like a laughing hyena with one limp on it. And a cat was, you know, I didn't come from that. I didn't come from that. Alcohol took me there. The alcohol took me right there, and I wasn't ashamed of it. It was the way it was. That's the crazy part about it. And but I'll tell you what, man, we pulled up in front of a church over there, and there was a big AA sign outside. We pulled up in the old Pinto. She's driving me. I looked in. And it was full of people, just like tonight. And I remember thinking, well, I've sunk to the bottom now. My friends will never have anything to do with me again. You know, that's low-bottom snobbery. and she sensed my approach avoidance and I stuck that butcher knife in my face and said, if you come out of that door before the meeting's over, I'm going to gut you, Slick, so stay in there. Yeah, I believed her, and I went to meetings and beat the deal, and then I got drunk, and I got drunk, and I got drunk, and I got sober, and I went to AA. By the time I was 20 years old, I'd been to 27 different jails and two penitentiaries. Now, this is in a time whenever, it was easy to do that. In a lot of towns and whatever, Pikey was talking about being in all those jails. I mean, you could do that. People come and got you out. They just took you and let you sobered up. But when I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous in the 70s, I went to over 500 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous drunk. Or just about drunk, or going to get drunk, or in a blackout. And I would come out of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and get drunk. Because I didn't go there to change anything but the consequences. I wanted to change the consequences. I didn't go there to change me. I went there to change the consequences. And the consequences changed. I can assure you that. The consequences changed. It never gets better. It always gets worse. And when it gets worse, then it gets worser. No matter how far down the scale you go, man, I know what it's like to stand in my kitchen. I'm drinking a bottle of vodka, look down a hallway, a 9-year-old girl standing down the hallway. I look at her, I turn around and take a drink because I got to have a drink because there's a phenomenon of craving going on inside of me that's much more powerful than prayer or shame or guilt or love. And I had to have a drink, and I look back, and she'd be gone. Day after day after day, I know what it's like standing in my bathroom, and I'm looking at me in the mirror, and I look through the hole in the door in the bathroom where I probably stuck my foot, and 10-year-old girl's looking through the hole in the door in that bathroom, and she's watching me drink and do what I got to do. She didn't say, Daddy, what are you doing today? Come play with me. She's watching me, and just for a second in my life, my whole heart, everything inside of me screaming, if there's something out there, anything out there, whatever's out there, please shut this thing off because I really don't want to live like this. I really didn't want to live, but there was not a word coming out of my mouth. It was just actions. My body was like some kind of a machine that had to put stuff in me and put stuff in me. I'm the type of an alcoholic that has a phenomenon of craving. There are certainly many types of alcoholics, but I am the type of alcoholic that has a physical phenomenon that is much greater than my mind. And I went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm so grateful today that I understand the phenomenon of craving that I don't have to feel guilty for all the times I went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and got drunk again and again and again, and the disappointment and the broken dreams and busted promises again and again and again because I never had any sobriety. I never put anything together that was long enough to be able to break the phenomenon of craving, and I went in and out and in and out. And that destroys people's faith and hope. And I got baptized so many times, my little girl said, Daddy, please don't make me do that again. My skin looks like a prune. And no faith, no hope. It steals people's souls. This disease will rob them of their souls. They have nothing to believe in, no hope, no future, nothing to look forward to. And the amazing thing about it is my family didn't know they could leave because I ruled that place with the terror of alcoholics. I'm here, you gotta stay here. Many times I would get up in the middle of the night and run down a hallway where a little girl's room was and go in and put my ear down next to her mouth to see if she's breathing. So it's just a matter of time. Just a matter of time till I snuffed the life out of everything that loved me. Cause I hated me, I loathed me, I couldn't stand me, I knew not what was wrong with me. And yet everybody around me, if you told me, we either attract the things we fear the most or we attract the things we love the most. And I was attracting the things that I feared the most. Everything that I loved, everything that was near and dear to me, I was squeezing out of my life. Friends, enemies. I ran out of friends and enemies at the same time. Wasn't anybody there. And I came back to AA. I came back to AA one more time. I didn't have anything going for me. She was gone. She was numb. There wasn't any more screaming or yelling. There wasn't anything left. We were like helpless little animals. We'd been to AA, been to church, been to therapy, been to National Council of Alcoholism. We rode a bus over to the National Council of Alcoholism, and he said, we don't know what to do with you. And I walked outside, and I remember standing leaning against the wall. My wife and daughter standing there, and I said, see there? Not even the National Council of Alcoholism knows what the hell to do with me. And I got a bottle out of my boot and I drank. And we rode the bus back home day after day. And just because I went to Alcoholics Anonymous didn't mean that I was going to get sober or do anything. I'll tell you this much, I would go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I would hear the answer and I would go home and I'd tell her, look, hey, you know what? I've been to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and we've got to quit fighting. We've got to quit fighting. We fought all the time, physical violence all the time. We've got to stop fighting everything and everybody. And she said, okay. And then she'd take one step closer and say, I need some money. And I said, don't get in my face. And she'd take one step closer. And I said, you take one more step, I'm going to hit you. And she'd take one more step. Bam! The fight would be on and we'd be fighting again and I'd be drunk. Then I'd come back to Alcoholics Anonymous and go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'd honk and sniff on the girls and I'd run home and I'd be sober and I'd get in the bedroom. I'm horny. And she'd say, you haven't made love to me in years, puke. Then we'd have a fight over who was whose lore companion. And then I'd be off down in Anaheim Street in Long Beach, you know, with the ladies of the night. Drunk again. And I'd go back to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and do the money thing and the hot checks. And I would come home and she'd say, I need some money. I said, sure, I'll write you a check, you know. And she went to jail for my check. And I'm the kind of guy that puts $800 in eight banks and writes $8,000 worth of checks. And the minute I said, I'll give you a check, the fight was on, and I was out the door and went down to the liquor store, wrote a hot check, and drunk again. The same me will always drink again. And I can't stay sober in an environment where I drank, and I was going home to a sick house. I was going home to a drunk house. There was no change. There was no family recovery there. And what was going on was we didn't know we were ignorant of things. Nobody told me in that AA meeting that I went to once a week that I needed family recovery. They didn't even know I had a family other than they were sitting out in the pinto. They knew I didn't need a sponsor because she was out in the pinto. They knew I didn't need a big book because she didn't need it, and I'd give it to her. And nobody asked me for a ride home or anything. And that's the way it was in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous I was going to. And I didn't stay sober. And I went home to a sick house in a crazy environment. And it just got worse and worse and worse. Ultimately, I had owed a lot of money and some things were coming down. And I tried to pull a couple of last deals and it didn't work. And I ended up drunk, sober, and then just nothing. I went to Taft, California, and bought a room for $50 a year. Does anybody here know where Taft is? One guy back there, only because I took him there. It ain't hell, but it's close. You can see it from there. It's Taft is an oil field town. It's like an old barracks there. You can get a room for $50 a year, man. It's like it's a good place to hide out. And I hid out in there in December of 1975. And I hid out there until sometime in May of 1976. I came back and had a lot of heat on, a lot of things gone wrong. And I went called and made a 12-step call to the central office. And Wheelchair Jack was on the phone down at the Orange County Central Office. And Wheelchair Jack and Little Jack Callahan, both those guys are gone now. But they were kind of buddies. They'd been in pilots. And Wheelchair Jack crashed his plane and didn't walk away. And Jack Callahan crashed his plane and walked away. And they teased each other. And they were both sober in AA. And Wheelchair Jack called Jack Callahan and tricked him. I couldn't get anybody coming to us at me over at my house for 3 days. And because people had come and I'd raise hell and shoot the place up and all kinds of crazy stuff. It was crazy. And drunk. Really, really drunk. And little Jack, bless his heart, little Jack Callahan had worked all day, got that call. Wheelchair Jack sent him over there, and he came over to my house and walked up the front door. And I stuck a .357 Magnum in his face, and I said, if you take me to the nut ward one more time, I'm going to kill you. And he took the gun away from me and pushed me inside, shoved me on a couch. I sit down there and start bawling. And God bless that little man. God bless him. I called him every Tuesday until he died. He'd always say to me, where are you talking next, big guy? And I said, well, you know, I'm going to go over here. And he said, be sure and tell him you wouldn't have nothing to say if it weren't for me. Don't you love old-timers like that? God, he kept me straight, man. He kept me right on the deal. And God bless him, he did a 12-step call on me and my family. It took him 3 or 4 hours to get me in a place. And he finally got me in a place. And he went home and told my wife and my daughter. that he thought maybe I might be able to click this time, and if they would go down on an Alateen, maybe there's a chance. There had to be some changes in that house. And he spent an hour talking to my wife over there, and then he'd sit down and talk to my daughter Simone, and he carried the message of Alateen. A member of Alcoholics Anonymous did a 12-step on a family and carried the message to Alateen to my daughter and told her, your daddy's sick, and you need to, you've been affected by this, you need to go to Alateen. And I'm so grateful for that, because he put me in down in a St. Joseph Hospital in Orange, and you know, when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. And here I am running and gunning and slinging and snotting, and they put me in there. And Dr. Paul Olliger, who's gone now, one of the great people in my life, Dr. Paul read me like a book, and they assigned him to me and me to him. And man, oh man, I sit down in there, and that guy, well, he was writing his story for the big book at that time. And I sit down there, and he told his story, and he read my book. He read my book, and I knew. This is the program of identity, and I knew the identity. It's the language of the heart. They weren't slinging crap at me, man. They were talking Alcoholics Anonymous. For the first time in my life, in over 6 years of going in and out of AA, I'm sitting in front of a guy that understands this kind of an alcoholic, that's talking to me about what I can do and what I got to do and the way I got to do it, and if I do that, then I can stay sober. And little Jack came back to see me, and he told me I needed a sponsor, and I said, what's that? A friend? And he said, no, if you want a friend, get a dog. Say, you're an idiot. You need somebody. An idiot's been running your life for all these years. You need somebody to help you make some decisions. I was sweetly reasonable. I have never, from that day on, argued with a sponsor. I have never, from that day on, debated recovery. What is there to debate from that day on? From May 11, 1976, I've had the same home group, and I've been there all the time. This is non-negotiable, non-debatable. What is there to debate? Leave? Where am I going to go? Where am I going to go if I left? I remember I was riding home from a meeting with Dr. Paul, and Dr. Paul, I said, man, I had this lady alcoholic, and I don't identify with her. I'm a tough guy. This gal has a toast burner, and she's laying in the kitchen floor drunk, and I want to leave that meeting. No, Paul said, well, I never have left an AA meeting because I don't know where I'd go if I left. He said, the whole point is maybe if you listen to the last 5 minutes what she had to say, she might tell you what she's doing to stay sober, and you sure need to know that. Don't you just love them old-timers and put it right like that? See? I remember I was going to do a 4-step to get out of there. And I thought, well, man, I've been all over the world. I've done things, been up and down, around and around, goaty bow, and seen a clown. And I'm going to need a book. And guy took a match book and opened it up and took the matches out and the paper clip so I wouldn't hurt myself. And a little short pencil, and he said, you can do a 4-step on this, slick. And I was looking at this. He said, start out with, you're a liar. How do they know that? How do they know that? I started out. I started doing a deal. I had to do a 4-step to get out of that place. I did a immoral inventory and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I said, they said, you need to do the steps. And I'm over there locked up in this place. They're detoxing me. This is the first time ever people detoxed me. I'm detoxing. I'm shaking and baking. I said, how about some Valium or some hard candy or something, you know? And I said, no, have a banana. You need a banana. You need potassium. They put a banana in your mouth and shut up. Have a banana. They weren't nice to me. Nobody said, love is the answer for you, slick. They said, sit down, shut up, and we'll tell you. That's why I always say, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith, because they told me in the very beginning, say your disease and then your name. It's circumstantial evidence of the rest of your life. It's all messed up. You don't have anything going for you. And I stayed in that place just exactly like they told me to do. I did exactly what they told me to do, and they kept me in there for several months. And I remember something. Pikey touched on it today. I love him because he said, this ain't a popularity contest, and to heck with the vote. I'll tell you what, man. When I got out of that St. Joseph's Hospital over there, there was 39 of us in there. 39, I was in that first class of St. Joseph's Hospital, Dr. Paul and Dr. Zuska, and I was in the first class, and 38 people said I was going to drink when I got out. They gave me my first AA resentment, and but I stayed sober, and at a year I went back, and there was only 11 out of 39 that could take a one-year cake, that came to take a cake. And I don't know how many are left, but I think I'm the only one that certainly have been sober continuously for 28 and a half years. So the vote doesn't make any difference, and this ain't a popularity contest. I didn't come here to be popular. I came here to get sober and learn how to stay sober, and I'm grateful to the old-timers that would not slack up on me. And they took me to meetings, and they told me to shut up and listen. And I went to Indian Charlie's, and I went to all those places over there where you couldn't talk for a year or two. And I just went to meetings, and I went home, and I shut up at home. And Sue went to Al-Anon, and Simone went to Alateen, the dog went to Alley Dog, and the cat went to Alley Cat, and they all released me. And they did. I mean, it's like, and they all had a brain. They all amazed me, you know. They could do things, but they did. We started having recovery in that house. We started cleaning that house up. We had to take that drunk house and clean it up and fix it up. And do things. And I remember we had that house fixed up, and old Ron McCartan was over there with me, and from Anaheim, and my daughter was going to Alateen, and she was asked to be the spiritual speaker at the Bakersfield Roundup on Sunday morning, Alateen speaker. And I thought, you know, I should be the speaker here, not the kid, you know. And I mentioned that to Ron, and he just said, "Why don't you just sit down, shut up, and listen?" And we put our old house up for sale, and we went up to Bakersfield, and I sit there in that back of that room and listen to Simone talk about her higher power. Because that's all she had when she got here. She was 13 years old. And the only thing that she had left was her higher power, some power, some force greater than herself, greater than me, and her mother, and the terrible damage between her and her mother. And I sit there in the back of that room, and I listened to her talk about a power in her life, and I cried daddy tears of joy, not tears of sorrow. For the first time in my life, I could see something happen. I couldn't take any credit for it. All I was doing was not drinking. Alateen was doing that. The Alateens told her, "You can achieve your dreams. You can look beyond where other people's fear to go." And I'm going to tell you, back then, back in 76, 77, 78, people want to talk about Alateen sponsors. I wouldn't brag about that. There were some sick Alateens back there. I mean, sick. They were going through all kinds of crazy stuff. Crazy, crazy stuff, rebelling against their parents. And it was unbelievable. And Simone went all the time to Alateen. And those kids encouraged her and told her to keep her, you know, eyes off of me. And Sue went to Al-Anon. And God bless those old-timers over there, man. Oh, Elsie Quintard, man, a tough old gal. Tough old gal, worked for the cop shop down there. And I'd tell her, "Alcoholic, got some sympathy." And old Elsie Quintard would say, "Just go to a meeting, shut up." And good morning. God, I love it, man. Elsie was so tough, she never slacked up one bit on me, man. And her husband had died drunk. And Rotten Ron had been with him, and they'd drunk. And they'd take him home and he'd be drunk. And they'd put him in the back seat of the car, and they'd put flowers in his hand, put his hands like that, so it looked like he was dead. And scared old Elsie to death every time that she thought maybe he was really dead. And he finally did. But Elsie, God bless her soul, she's still over there. Tough old people, believed in it. They didn't water it down. Those kind of people told me, "Don't water it down with somebody else's blood. Mind your own business." And that's hard to do. I told a guy one time, "I'm just going to go over there and mind my own business." And he said, "If you're going over there, you ain't minding your own business." You ever think of that? That's kind of stupid, ain't it? I mean, if I'm going to go over there, how can I mind my own business? Nah, they didn't slack up on me at all. I had a guy in Whittier was going to kill me. I owed a bunch of money to, and they told me, I was down at the Anaheim Milano Club hanging around, "Go over there and make amends to that guy." I said, "Well, I don't know if I'm on that step yet." "Well, it don't make any difference. Get over there and make amends to that guy. Tell him you're sorry and you're going to AA." And I went over. This guy was all coked out. He was a union guy, and he was all crazy, and he hated me, and I owed him money and everything. And I went up and knocked on the door. He come to the door, his eyes that big around, gun in each hand. And I said, "I'm going to AA. It's going to be okay." It scared him to death. He's like, "Huh?" I ran like hell back down to my old truck and drove back down to the Anaheim Milano Club, ran in. They said, I thought we told you to go to Whittier. I did. I went to Whittier, and they said, and he didn't kill you? I said, nope. Well, I'll be damned. And I get it. They send you out there to try it. If it works, they try it. I know. They always say, try this. I said, well, I don't know if I'm on that step yet. It don't make no difference. Try this and see if it works. Then we'll know what step you're on. You know? I didn't know. I didn't know what to do. I was working, going to work, and trying to pay that money back and barring. I'd work all the time, try to go. I'd go to meetings all over the country and went to meetings all over the United States. I found meetings where there was one, you know, people say, there was some guy sitting in a fire station that went to a meeting every Friday night for 20 years and nobody ever came. I found him. I did. Down in Midland, Texas. Big Springs, Texas. I found that guy. I went up to Alaska and Canada. I went to Canada up there and found, you know, native Canadians. I went to meetings over there and teepees and through a blizzard, I would look for Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have any other choices. And I would come home. Sue would be doing okay. And I worked, and I worked myself out of that hole. I had worked for that company for 10 years, and I sobered up in 1976, and I was able to get a job with the company, and I was still a field representative, and I was out in the field a lot and what have you, which gave me time to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was up in Bakersfield, Oildale, went to the old 34th Street Club. I love the old 34th Street Club, Oildale meetings, met some great AA people up there, went to meetings all the time. I was down in Texas, working in Midland, Odessa, Texas, went to meetings down Midland and the club down there. People took me and rocked me to sleep, and I'd come home and I'd try to do what I could to help my family, and I'd take care of my debts. I had so many debts that I just had to take care of my debts. And Sue was going to Al-Anon, and she didn't deprive me of the privilege of making my financial amends either. She didn't help me at all, and I had to clean up all that stuff, and I had to pay it back. It wasn't, is there any way I can escape all this financial amends? And yeah, you can go pay it back. Go tell that guy you want to pay him his money back. I don't like that. I owed over $200,000, and I had to pay it back. It took me 14 years sober to pay it back, and I didn't have an overwhelming great feeling about it because I had nothing to show for it. I did it simply because I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to be a good guy. I had to pay it back because I didn't want to drink. There was no escape. They didn't let up on me. See? By the time I was 10 years sober, I'd worked for this company for 20 years, and I'd been an expediter, and I'd been disposing of some hazardous chemicals the wrong way, and I got involved with some people with some laundering, some money and that kind of type of stuff, and illicit behavior, which I had been involved with them for a long time. I had a good position. I was doing good. My wife was doing good. My daughter, we had a new home, a nice thing. 10 years sober, slicking along. You know, I'd been the chairman of the Southern California Convention. I'd been the head sick. And, you know, we were a happy family and all that stuff. And I'm 10 years sober, and I'm involved with all these things I hadn't quit doing when I sobered up. See? I looked at those things that were happening to me at 10 years sober, and I hadn't quit doing them. I didn't involve anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had another life. It's one thing to tell a lie, but it's another thing to live a lie. And I can't live a lie and stay sober. And at 10 years sober, God bless the old-timers that waited on me. God bless the old-timers that waited on me. Because I got hit with a freight train. I didn't wake up one morning and say, I worked the steps, I'm ready to get serene. I woke up one morning and there was a knock at my door, and it was the FBI. And my world stopped. You know, I look at that, you know, I don't know about God. I really don't. If he was small enough for me to know, he wouldn't be big enough to help me. But I tell you this much. It's kind of like 10 years sober, and I remember a story about Billy and Bobby. And Billy and Bobby was two little boys, and they were just mischievous little boys, and just little boys, and they were always in trouble. And their mother told them, you know, if you guys don't straighten up, I'm going to take you down to the church, the big church, you know, the big church where the priest is, the big church, and you're going to get in trouble. You have to go see the priest. And they just kept jackassing around, and they got in trouble, and they got in trouble. Finally, one day, mother said, come on, we're going down to the church. takes them down to church in a big long stairway up, and mother says, okay, Bobby, you go up there first and you go see that priest. And so Mom and Billy stay down at the bottom of the stairs, and Bobby goes up the stairs, and he goes down and down through the aisles way down at the bottom, and here's this giant of a man, the priest. And the priest looks down at Bobby and says, I just want to know one thing. The kid looking at him, where's God? The kid, little Noy, where's God? Bobby took off running like heck, ran back out through down the steps, got down at the bottom. Billy said, what's up? He said, I don't know, man, but somebody stole God and they think we did it. That was me at 10 years sober. I mean, I'm action. I'm doing things. I'm sponsoring people. I'm involved in service. I've been intergroup rep. I've been rep to the rep and revision to the revision. Whatever it is, I did it. And peddling. And I'm so grateful that I didn't have to go. When I went through it 10 years, I'm grateful I was 10 years, because I could not have handled it at 10 months or 10 days or anything less than 10 years. And at 10 years, my world stopped. And I got an opportunity to change. And my whole career changed. My whole life changed. And I'm 10 years sober, and I'm going to 6 a.m. I was a guy, Reuben, went to brand new 18, 19 years ago. And I take Reuben to the 705 Club, 6 a.m. meeting. I'm 10 years sober sitting in there. And I got nothing going for. I got no job. I got nothing. I've been excommunicated. I'm sitting waiting for a 45-day hearing to determine whether I'm going to do time in the penitentiary, 10 years sober. And everybody's saying, well, maybe there's a message you need to take to somebody in the penitentiary. And I'm going to tell you something. That may be right, but I'm not volunteering for it. It cost me $50,000 to get a lawyer just to step up. And it wasn't that big of a deal. It was just a deal, and they tried to put the heat on somebody that's a lot bigger than me, and they got four of us under the deal and tried to make it happen, and it didn't happen. But I my world stopped. Got an opportunity. I'm grateful for participation. If it had all been speaker meetings, I'd have died. I went to meetings, the participation meetings, and I was able to hold my hand up and say, I'm 10 years sober, my ass is falling off. And I'm grateful for the old-timers that believe that 10 years sober is just as important to save as 10 days. Because there's people sitting around alcoholics, and I'm dying with years of sobriety, and people let them walk right on by. Man, I don't ever do that, man. Them guys saved my bacon because they took me by the hand and said, come go with me. We'll show you what we did when we went through that. And I got a chance to stop. And I got a chance to stand still and let the waves of the past roll over me. That period of time, I knew if it was something and I was stopping and starting and stopping and starting, I'm going to end up getting drunk. But it was something I never stopped doing. And I got a chance to stop and start over. And it didn't happen overnight. It was a year and a half period of time, and I looked at all different kinds of things. My wife and daughter went to meetings. I was working with newcomers all the time, and I didn't double up because the heat was on. I kept doing what I'd been doing all the way through that to get to 10 years. And I went to my home group, and I let the people in my home group know how I was doing and how I was hurting. And I let the newcomers rock me to sleep. It was their turn. And I worked with those guys day in and day out. My wife knew as long as I was with those guys, I was going to be okay. And I came out the other side of that deal a better person. I'm not going to say that was one of those circumstances that hits you so that you improve or something steps you up. It was part of my past that caught up with my ass, and it hit me real hard. And I didn't want to do it, but I had to do it because I did not want to drink. And I had to go get a job and start my career over. And I'm 46 years old and 10 years sober. I went from the oil industry to the aircraft industry, and I went to work for McDonnell Douglas. And I worked for McDonnell Douglas for the next 15 years. And I went to school, and I went to their sessions, and I went to work, and I clocked in, and I clocked out. And I worked for crap heads and women. Not the same, but I just never had a woman boss before. And I got along. I made it. I never got fired. And I showed up. And I didn't even have a car. I never went to work over there where they said, we'll let you come in here because we're going to take a chance. We have to hire a few handicapped people like you. I went in on the minority. I was a felon. And they let me work there for 15 years, and I went to work every day, and I worked. I became a team leader, and I became an example for my fellow workers. And I was able to show up, and in the year 2000, I was able to retire and have a retirement. People say, well, this is a living immense. Let me tell you something. Last year, my wife, been married that time 42 years, 43 years, 44, somewhere in there, long time. She needed a hip. She needed a hip. And you know what? Because I worked over there and retired over there and got insurance over there and got a retirement over there because sober, I went to work. I did what they told me to do. I took my deductions. I put it in the credit union. I bought insurance. Last year, I was able to pay completely for a hip replacement for my wife. That's a living amend. Stay on the damn job and get the insurance for the bitch. I'm serious. That's a living amend for me. It's not talking about it. She gets what she deserves. It's clocking in every day and clocking out every day. And keeping my mouth shut. Yes, sir. No, sir. Have my head down. Yes, sir. No, polish my spot. Put that check in the bank and pay them bills. The first time I went to work over there, I got a week's check. And I'm going to tell you what, I made more than 15 minutes scamming and jamming on the street, and I did for 40 hours. And I looked at that, man, $243 for 40 hours? And then I thought, but it's mine. It's mine. It's mine. I don't have to look over my shoulder for this. Okay? And when all that stuff went down, I didn't hold those grudges and stuff. I held my head up. I remember the old timer said, when you go through these centers, hold your head up and walk out of there. Don't let them rob you of your dignity. And I held my head up because I was sober. And the old me would have said, if you hurt me, I'll tell you what, bub, someday something bad's going to happen to you. And when it does, look over your damn shoulder. I'll be standing back there. And I didn't say those things. Those things were gone in my vocabulary. I didn't hold those revenges and hating. Can't do that. I got absolutes. I don't know what your absolutes are, but I've got absolutes. And my absolutes have been that way from May 11th, 1976 to this minute right here. I went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 years violating those absolutes. The violence had to stop. I didn't have to intellectualize anger. I had rage. You could stick a drink in my hand when I'm in rage, and I would have drunk it. And it had to stop. Not a little bit, altogether. I haven't hit anybody since May 11, 1976. I haven't cheated on my wife since May 11, 1976. Got to quit them games. They say, trust God, clean house, and work with others. No, I need to clean house, work with others, and then maybe I'll trust God. I woke up one morning, and I knew I trusted God because I knew I was trustworthy. I was trustworthy. The curse of a thief is that he can't trust himself. I was trustworthy. I had not cheated on my wife in well over 10 years at that time. And those were games we were playing. It wasn't any big deal. I hadn't cheated on her, and she hadn't cheated on me. There was trust in that relationship. Trust! Something I knew nothing about. You trust God, clean house, work with others. I'm not trustworthy. I'm not trustworthy. How can I trust God if I'm not trustworthy? I got to be doing things where he could trust me before I can even conceive trust. And I haven't written a hot check since that day, May 11, 1976. Nor have I debated God. If talking about God offends you, I'm sorry, but I'd a hell of a lot rather offend you than I would offend God. I offended him way too long, baby. Way too long. Ain't even a debate. Not even a debate. My daughter was able to achieve a dream. She wanted to be a model, and she became a model, was able to go to Italy. Went all over the world and modeled. It took me 8 years sober before I could distinguish the difference between joy and fear. Because they were like two shoes. When one hit, the other one hit. And because there is no spot where God is not, my daughter was able to go do what she needed to do and achieve a dream because of Alateen. The Alateens gave her the strength to do what she wanted to do, not her mom and dad. I've never worked on my relationship with my daughter. I worked on my relationship with my God, and my daughter is fine. She has never, ever disappointed me because I've never, ever had an expectation of her. I expect nothing. She was able to go to Italy and get a job and work, become a model, do a lot of things in the program. She's in the program 28 and a half years without a gap, just like her mom and dad. We've been in this program 28 and a half years without any geographics, any time off with good behavior, or any vacations, or any kind of zip me and try me. We've done that. We've tried all that crap before, and it didn't work. Stayed right where you are. Don't drink, don't use, and don't run. Hang tough and let the old-timers help you. Stand still and watch the chain. And our daughter was able to go over there because of Alateen and Al-Anon. Our daughter was able to achieve a spiritual value that allowed her to be attracted to a healthy man. Wow, what a concept. I want my kid to go to Alateen and Al-Anon so that she can get a spiritual life where she's attracted to a healthy man. See? And she did. And she married him. And they're happy. And he's a good man. He's not an alcoholic. He has a lot of my character defects. She didn't marry in the image of her father, but he's not an alcoholic. He's a workaholic. And she's never had to wire home for money, I'll tell you that for sure. And they have a little girl, a little five-year-old girl. And I've been able to be a grandpa. I'm not talking about something I deserve. I'm talking about something that happened to me because I was doing the next right thing. And because I was doing the next right thing, my daughter came over here when that little girl was months old, flew 19 hours with that little baby and came to Los Angeles, into the airport down there, and walked up to me, standing there next to her mother, and handed me a little baby girl. And that little girl's eyes were sparkling. She was laughing and cooing, and I jackass around there, man. I wanted everybody to see this. And that little girl was smiling and giggling. And I backed up, and I looked at Simone and Sue, and they were standing there looking at me. Because that little girl wasn't afraid of me. She had no reason to fear me. She knew not the way I treated her mother or grandma, but she had no reason whatsoever to fear me. And I hope if I keep doing what I'm doing tonight, just maybe the chain is broken. Maybe the chain of alcoholism is broken. Maybe that little girl will never, ever have a reason to fear me. That isn't too much. It's worth it. It isn't necessarily my dream, and it won't keep me sober. It's a byproduct of Alcoholics Anonymous and the principles in this program of doing. When they say half measures avail you nothing, that's what it means. But if you do it, you reap the reward. You will reap the reward. If you do what the old-timers tell you to do, Pikey said it today, man. If you do them deals, you get to stay sober. You hold your head up and you walk out there with the dignity of a sober human being. That isn't just a macho thing. You ladies got to quit using your body for a meal ticket, too. I'll tell you a quick story. I like stories. You might have heard it before, but I like to tell it. It's a story about a family, a mother and father and a little girl. They lived in some foreign port somewhere, I don't know, but it was a little place where a great ocean liner came in. And they would go down. They were a beautiful family. Nothing wrong with them. They were just mother and father and a little girl. And they had very little money. And they'd go down this ocean port, and this great ocean liner would come in. And they had a dream, kind of had a fantasy to see this big ocean liner. And they thought, man, maybe someday we could go on that wherever it goes. And they made a pact among themselves to save their money and pool their resources. They didn't have much money, but they'd save their money. And someday they'd be able to take a trip on that great ocean liner. And they did that. They worked very hard. They had unity, and they pooled their money, and their dream came true, and they packed all their stuff in their suitcases and everything that they had, and they went down and bought passage on the great ocean liner, and they went in, and they got their little room and porthole and put their stuff out, and they're watching as the great ocean liner sailed away. And the mother loved the father, and the father loved the mother, and they loved the little girl. There was an abundance of love and everything that you could ever imagine. Everything, their dream had come true. And 4 days into that journey, it turns out that all the money they had, they didn't have any money to buy anything, including food, so all they had was some crackers and cheese, and they put crackers and cheese in their bag, and they got in this room, and they stayed in this room. After 4 days, the little girl went to her daddy and said, "Daddy, Daddy, I'm hungry. I just can't stand crackers and cheese anymore." And the father, being a good father, said, "Okay, here's a quarter, go up to the galley and get an ice cream. And the little girl left, and she was gone for a long, long time. The mother and father were worried sick. They had no idea why she'd be gone that long. Pretty soon there was a knock at the door, and the father opened the door, and there stood a little girl, smiled from ear to ear. And he said, "Where have you been? We've been worried sick about you. Why did it take you so long?" She said, "Oh, Daddy, I went up to the galley, and I got steak and potatoes and green beans, and I got all the good stuff and dessert. It all food's free. It comes with a ticket." That's not a story about love. That's a story about teachers. That's a story about ignorance. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had two different degrees from college. I had all kinds of knowledge. I was 36 years old. I'd been up and down and round and round, but I knew nothing. I was ignorant. I wasn't stupid. I was ignorant because alcohol and the progressiveness of my disease destroyed everything about my will to live and enjoy and have good things in life. I was ignorant. And that's a story about ignorance because they didn't know. It's a story about teachers. Because there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous who are satisfied with crackers and cheese. I came here with crackers and cheese, bub, and I ain't satisfied with it. I want a meal like I got tonight. I want the ticket. I want the whole enchilada. I want to enjoy life. I didn't come here to turn it off. I came here to turn it on. I want to enjoy things. I want to see that little girl grow up. I want to see my daughter smile again. I want to wake up next to that lady and feel the feeling of love and the knowledge of I'm right on time. Right on time, baby. I ain't out of step. I'm right where I'm supposed to be doing exactly what I'm supposed to do. And I want the whole thing, and I hope you do too. God bless and thank you.
Thank you, Keith. Thank you very much. Thank you, Keith.